I would say that behind Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson was the most influential member of the right. And I don't just mean ideologically, I also mean culturally. So you could have some really interesting cultural effects where a lot of the loudest, angriest, and most malicious voices don't have that direct line to the Republican public like they did when Tucker was in that chair.
That's conservative New York Times columnist David French, discussing the fallout from Tucker Carlson's abrupt departure from Fox News. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
When it comes to the United States of America, there is no us and them. It's just us.
French is an evangelical Christian who practiced law for 2 decades, litigating religious liberty cases in federal courts and serving as a judge advocate general in Iraq. He has become a prominent anti-Trump voice on the right, first at National Review, then as co-founder of The Dispatch, and now bringing his perspective to readers of The New York Times.
This is not a time to be complacent. That's why I'm running for re-election.
I spoke to French as the country faces the prospect of a long and divisive Biden-Trump rematch.
There's an enormous amount of disillusionment in the larger public that these could be the two nominees again.
We discuss the massive Fox News defamation settlement.
True accountability at Fox would look like a house cleaning.
And Trump's mounting legal trouble.
Is it within the realm of possibility that Donald Trump will serve prison time?
Let me put it this way. These are cases that if brought against anyone other than a former president of the United States, and I'm their lawyer and I'm advising my client, I would say you are facing potentially years in prison.
David French, welcome to Firing Line.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You have said that the greatest threat to America is the ever-deepening polarization throughout the country. President Biden announced this week he is running for re-election. The prospect of another Trump-Biden matchup appears likely, and I want to know what impact you think this will have on our country.
I think the top line is if Trump wins the Republican nomination, the campaign is going to be incredibly vicious. The campaign is going to be incredibly divisive just by its nature and the nature of how Donald Trump campaigns. And then if you add on top of that, there's an enormous amount of disillusionment in the larger public that these could be the two nominees again. Democrats, for example, are not exactly overjoyed at the notion of Joe Biden running again. They'll certainly line up to vote for him over Donald Trump, make no mistake. But this is not a ticket that truly, honestly, is going to excite too many people except for the Trump diehards. And so we're going to see a combination of bitterness and disillusionment, I think, if that's who is actually in the contest at the end of the day.
In 2020, you wrote in your book, Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How We Restore Our Nation, quote, "The quest for moral, cultural, and political domination by either side of our national divide risks splitting the nation in two, or in three, or in four."
Right.
How serious of a threat do you think this is now?
Yeah, when I wrote that book in 2020, it came out in September 2020, and I was actually a little bit nervous. Was this going to be taken seriously? Because would people perceive me as being engaging in some hyperbole? And then January 6th happened. And when January 6th happened, that was something that in my worst case scenario, I did not see happening that quickly. And the best way I think to describe the United States of America culturally right now, and I was talking the other day to some experts in civil strife and civil wars, and they said, imagine that you have dry kindling with kerosene on it. And all that is needed is the right spark to hit in the right place or at the right time to ignite something that's not like 1861, that's not a schism quite like that, but to ignite a level of civil unrest, to ignite a level of political violence that will really strain the system. And I just don't think it's too much to say that we're at risk of that. And I think we'll be in particular risk of that during 2024, especially if Trump is the standard bearer for the Republican Party.
Well, you've described Florida under Governor Ron DeSantis as, quote, one of the hotspots of right-wing censorship and punitive government. DeSantis is widely expected to announce a 2024 campaign after his legislative session concludes in early May. Do you think his aggressive and vindictive style is really what is appealing to Republican voters?
It is very appealing to the online right. And I think what is happening is that DeSantis is making a mistake that many politicians have made, which is confusing Twitter with real life. And yes, the online right is very performative and it is very punitive. And so that is what you've seen from DeSantis. You've seen performative, punitive legislation. I say performative because a lot of it was passed. It was blatantly unconstitutional when passed and has already been blocked by courts. So it never even went into effect. But performative and punitive is the online right. In the much larger right, I'm not sure that that is the winning message, and especially not a winning message if the argument is, well, I'm like Trump, but I'm not Trump. Well, if that's what you're doing, then why wouldn't people go with the original Trump? Why wouldn't people go with the man who pioneered this entire form of politics, at least in this era in the Republican Party? So I think he's very online, and I think that, or at least his team, and I think that is going to hurt him and has hurt him.
I've heard you use the term online right. Give me some texture about what you mean when you say the online right.
Right. I think of the online right in much the same way that I think of the online left. More activist, more reactionary on the right, more aggressive, more likely to sort of view politics as your hobby. It's the thing that really gets you up in the morning, is engaging in politics. And the difference between the online right, it's also more ideological, not so much in the sense of old Reagan conservatism, but more in this new right reactionary populism. Whereas the rest of the right has much more of one foot still, believe it or not, still in the old school Reagan republicanism. A lot of folks who voted for Trump did not think, for example, that they were decisively returning the page on or rejecting sort of the republicanism of their past, that he was just the closest version of it between Trump and Hillary that they could vote for. So the online right, much like the online left, far more aggressive, far more polarized, far more angry, and far more obsessed with politics. And that's not necessarily the community that's going to elect the next president of the United States.
So if Governor DeSantis of Florida has done a great job of playing to the online right, has he been short-sighted in how he's established himself for the GOP primary?
Well, you know, ultimately it remains to be seen. It's all conjecture. But as of right now, it does appear that he's reached a point where he's forgetting who his true constituency is. If you actually look and see who his constituency is so far, it is college-educated Republicans who are ready to turn the page on Trump. And he actually hasn't pulled a lot of support from that core Trump base. And yet he's acting in many ways as if he's going to win by pulling from that core Trump base, as opposed to winning by showing that that core Trump base is actually a minority of the Republican Party. So he's got time to react. He's got time to adjust. He hasn't even announced yet. So it's way too early to write a postmortem of his candidacy. But I think he's made some decisions that unless he changes them, he's put a ceiling on his support.
David, you just said the majority of the party, or a large part of the Republican Party, is ready to move on from Trump. But we've also just seen, especially in the wake of the indictment of the former president, a solidifying of his support and a growing of his lead in the primary polls. So what is your evidence that the Republican Party is ready to move on from Trump, to turn the page?
So I think the word ready was probably an overstatement. I would say willing. Willing. There's a difference between ready to and willing to. And so if they're presented with an alternative, and I think here's the really key part of it, if they're presented with an alternative that they view as their choice, in other words, we're doing this as opposed to the media bullying us away from Trump, or these what are cast on the right as politicized prosecutors trying to bully us away from Trump, they're going to circle the wagons. A lot of the Republican base is going to circle the wagons as long as they feel like they're being told to leave Trump. And they're going to say, no, you media, you know, you don't get to tell us, or you prosecutors, you don't get to tell us who our candidate is going to be. But if there's an opportunity I look at the Brian Kemp primary election as a very interesting data point. So here you had the Georgia governor, public enemy number one in Trump world, because he defied Trump to uphold the election results in Georgia. Trump targets him specifically. Brian Kemp not only wins, then he goes on and he has enough Trump voters to win decisively in the general election. So he beats off a Trumpist challenger in the primary. He beats a Democrat by almost 10 points in the general. And a Brian Kemp situation demonstrates that Trump does not actually command the loyalty of all Republicans to the extent that one might think. But at the same time, it depends on who's making the call. Are they making the call? Or are they perceiving prosecutors as trying to bully them out of the call, or the media? And that's the dynamic we're working with.
The criminal prosecutions of Donald Trump have likely only just begun.
Right.
You said the Republican Party doesn't want them to feel like the media or someone else is picking their candidate or telling them who can't be their candidate.
Right.
So then, what do you think that bodes for the upcoming prosecutions in Georgia and by special counsel Jack Smith?
Well, if they happen, and there's a lot of expectations they will, number one, I think you have to apply the rule of law. You just have to. You can't be sitting there politically wargaming out these prosecutions. If there is evidence sufficient to present to a jury that Trump violated Georgia criminal law, bring the prosecution. He's a citizen. He's not a king. He's under the rule of law. Similarly, with the federal investigation, bring the prosecution. But at the same time, we can't in any way assume that the existence of those prosecutions, even if they're credible, even if there's an enormous amount of evidence supporting them, that they're going to chip away substantially at Trump's support within the Republican primary, which raises a host of problems, but still you apply the rule of law.
Of course, you apply the rule of law, but I think the flip side of what you're saying is that could actually be read by the Republican base as the media and the guys against Trump trying to tell them who to pick.
Certainly.
In other words, so do you believe that it could solidify his support as the leader for the primary?
I think it can solidify his support in the primary, and I think it undermines his support in the general election. What's the profile of the voter that says, well, I voted for Joe Biden in 2020, but Trump got indicted, so I'm going to vote for him now in 2024. That voting profile just doesn't exist on the American landscape. So you could have a situation where the indictments, again, if the Georgia indictment, if it occurs, will be a very credible indictment. Similarly, a federal indictment, we expect that these will be very credible indictments. We could be in this very weird situation where an indictment rightfully alienates independents and Democrats, and an indictment perversely bonds the Republican base to Trump in a way that's terrible for the Republican Party and terrible for the country.
Is it within the realm of possibility that Donald Trump will serve prison time?
It is within the realm of possibility. I do not believe it is with the Manhattan prosecution, but either the Georgia or the federal prosecutions, if brought, they would be alleging violations of felony statutes that carry with them the possibility of real prison time. Let me put it this way. These are cases that if brought against anyone other than a former president of the United States, and I'm their lawyer and I'm advising my client, I would say you are facing potentially years in prison. Now, the fact that Donald Trump is a former president of the United States might change the calculus to some degree, but the statutes are the statutes. The laws are the laws, and they provide for certain and prescribe certain kinds of punishments. And so if he is convicted, which is a huge if he is convicted, it is not unrealistic, it is not fantastical to say that he, as a former president of the United States, would have to serve time in either prison or perhaps some sort of home confinement that allows for the Secret Service to watch over him. I mean, there's a host of issues that come up. Do you have Secret Service protection in Georgia State Prison? Do you have Secret Service protection in federal prison? I presume that you would, of course. But it is not probable, but it is certainly possible that we could have a former president in prison.
The gears of justice, of course, grind slowly. If Trump were to win in 2024 and one or more criminal trials were continuing, what does it look like to have a president-elect or even a sitting president on trial for a criminal charge or facing prison time?
It would be a profound mess. So first, let's deal with the potential federal prosecution. If he could delay a trial and then ultimately wins the presidency, he could just order the Department of Justice to drop the case. I mean, he will be the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. The Justice Department can't prosecute a case over defying the will of the president. So he could order the case to be dropped against him. Now, the state prosecutions are different. They're not directly under his authority. But the amount of pressure brought to bear on a state court judge to either drop or delay, if you could constitutionally for that long, delay a prosecution to avoid a situation where a jury sentences a sitting president to prison, it just creates a potential nightmare. So it's very hard to believe that if he wins, that as just a matter of practical reality, that he would face these state trials. I think it's far more likely that he will face these state trials if they somehow occur before the presidential election, which is difficult, or if he loses. If he loses the election in 2024, I think it's not hard to imagine the trials at all.
Something you can speak to because of your own personal experience is the popularity that Trump has with evangelical Christians. Initially, of course, Trump was deeply unpopular. But in 2020, 8 in 10 evangelical voters backed him. You have described yourself as a, quote, traditional Orthodox evangelical.
Yes. And
you call the continued evangelical loyalty to Trump, quote, incredibly dark and appalling. How do you explain the fusion between evangelical voters and former President Trump?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I think at the end of the day, what you have to understand is that for a lot of evangelical voters, their republicanism has become a core part of their identity. So you're talking about generations now since the first Reagan administration, the first term of the Reagan administration, where generations of American Republican evangelicals have been brought up to believe and to be taught that their political identity and their religious identity are inseparable. And so when Trump ran against Hillary Clinton, if you're making the argument that, no, wait a minute, there are a number of evangelical principles that would say that you should be very reluctant to support Donald Trump or not support him at all, that was a very difficult thing just as a cultural reality to pry apart these identities. And then what you also have to understand is that a lot of these Republican evangelicals have, ever since Trump won, have been just completely immersed in the Fox News world, the right-wing media world. And so they have been convinced and they have been conditioned to believe for many years now that Trump's scandals when he was in office were primarily a result of progressive persecution rather than failings on the part of Donald Trump himself. And so they view him quite literally as a persecuted president who delivered for them on things like judges, for example. And so that is a mindset that is locked into such an extent that even now, when it's not a binary choice anymore, it's not Trump versus Biden, it's Trump versus other Republicans, even now, that bond with evangelicals still exists.
So then why aren't the likely candidates who are actually evangelical Christians, like Senator Tim Scott and former Vice President Mike Pence, garnering more support from evangelical voters?
Well, you know, one of the reasons is actually Trump influenced evangelical voters profoundly. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago that said Trump has discipled evangelicals more than evangelicals have discipled Trump. In other words, he has influenced evangelicals more than evangelicals have influenced him. And so he has really changed the culture of Republican politics in this very pugilistic way that's also extremely performative. And Tim Scott's a normal American politician. Pence is a normal American politician. He's out of step. They're out of step with the new culture of Republican politics that Donald Trump, I won't say entirely created, but perfected, if that's the right word, in its current form. So a lot of evangelicals have now been acculturated into an extremely performative, punitive form of politics that nobody is better at than Donald Trump.
Some of the ideas that Trump has proposed for a second term include deploying the military into cities to fight street crime, purging the federal workforce, pardoning the January 6th rioters, herding homeless people into tent cities. You have noted that the guardrails of democracy generally held against Trump and his most authoritarian impulses during his first term. What is your confidence level that this would continue to be the case if he were elected to another term as president?
My confidence level is not high because a second Trump term would begin very differently from the first Trump term. If you go back to 2017, you'll have seen that he staffed his administration with a lot of mainstream Republican figures. You'll see that the first major legislative accomplishment, and really the only major legislative accomplishment, was a Paul Ryan-designed tax cut. It was really only by 2019, 2020 that you began to see the administration take on the fully Trumpian flavor, where a lot of the establishment people had either been turned completely into Trumpists or had been expelled for or left the administration. And so what you'll see coming into a new Trump term is a team very similar in nature as the team he had around him at the end of 2020. And as we saw, that team around him and Trump combined with that team put our democracy under unbelievable strain. And so that's why I'm concerned. The Trump of 2025 and the Trump administration of 2025 would be very different from a Trump administration and staffing of 2017.
You wrote recently, David, that, quote, there may have been a time when Trump truly commanded his movement. That time is past. His movement now commands him. If Trump doesn't control the MAGA movement anymore, can anyone?
Well, the short answer to that is no. The longer, more hopeful answer to that is the MAGA movement at its core is a minority of the Republican Party. So there still is a majority of the Republican Party that I believe is capable of moving on from that MAGA movement. And we've seen it in gubernatorial races, for example. There's a host of Republican governors in the United States of America who you would not call Trumpian in any way, shape, or form. And they win resounding victories. And one thing that was telling in 2022 was that the most Trumpian candidates in the swing states, even though they could consolidate the whole MAGA base, underperformed compared to the conventional Republicans, in many cases, dramatically. I mean, think of Governor DeWine in Ohio with this huge win. Think of Governor Kemp in Georgia, where he won by almost 10 and Herschel Walker lost. So there is an ability to reforge a Republican coalition that is fundamentally different from the Trump and Trumpist coalition. It's larger, it's more expansive. But that requires getting through a primary where the MAGA movement has disproportionate influence and impact.
Well, on Monday, Fox News announced that the network and Tucker Carlson, quote, have agreed to part ways after more than a decade. At times, it has seemed like the Fox News personality who hosted the network's highly rated 8 p.m. hour and widely promoted conspiracy theories, lies, racist bigotry. It seemed from time to time that he even may have had more power within the Republican Party than many of its own elected officials. What is your reaction, David, to Tucker Carlson's departure from Fox News this week?
I would say that behind Donald Trump, Tucker Carlson was the most influential member of the right. And I don't just mean ideologically, I also mean culturally. In other words, the way in which Tucker interacted with the world, his malice, his dishonesty. I mean, these have become hallmarks of the new right or the Trumpist right. And he was a cultural driver of that. And he was also responding to a lot of malice from the the grassroots themselves. It was kind of a chicken or egg problem, but he contributed to it. And he was more influential, I believe, than anyone other than Donald Trump. So what will this mean? Remains to be seen who replaces him, of course. But what's important to understand about Tucker is not only is this a degree of accountability for that malice and dishonesty, he was also an engine of introducing a lot of new right and reactionary right ideas into the culture. They came through Tucker Carlson in a way they didn't come through any other Fox host. And so if you see the reaction from a lot of that reactionary right, that MAGA right, they're apoplectic. And they're apoplectic not just because they liked and appreciated Tucker, but Tucker was their introduction into the wider world. Tucker was their sort of meal ticket into that wider world. And so you could have some really interesting cultural effects where a lot of the loudest, angriest, and most malicious voices don't have that direct line to the Republican public like they did when Tucker was in that chair.
Do you think Tucker will continue his work on another platform? Can you imagine him going quietly into the night?
I don't think there's any scenario where he goes quietly into the night. But Tucker Carlson is not bigger than Fox News. Tucker Carlson commands an independent audience for certain, but it is not as big as or much less bigger than Fox News. He will take a hit in his influence unless, let's say, he runs for president, for example, and wins a primary. But as of this moment, Tucker has been cut off from the largest engine on the entire right, the largest platform on the right by far. And he cannot independently recreate that. And so I think you will see him diminish at least to some extent, but definitely not go away. Tucker Carlson is going to remain a player without any question. But you just don't replace a platform like he had 8 p.m. every weeknight on Fox News. You can't replace that at all.
And we've seen this before, David. I mean, we've seen this with Bill O'Reilly. We've seen this with Glenn Beck. We've seen this with other Fox News personalities who abused their platform, were made to account for it, and have remained diminished and less influential.
Oh, absolutely. There's precedent here. Glenn Beck, for a time, was an extremely highly rated, if not the most highly rated, Fox host. Bill O'Reilly was absolutely the highest rated Fox host. He was a colossus of primetime cable. He was the colossus. And both of them are very substantially diminished, even though they've not gone away. And so that's what I would expect with Tucker Carlson. But again, it's conjecture, but that's what I would expect. And the other thing, and you can't emphasize this enough, it's not just Tucker. He was the way in which a lot of right-leaning Americans were introduced to some of the more toxic personalities in American politics. He would defend and circle the wagons around some of the most toxic personalities in American politics. He would platform them. And I think the combination of shedding Tucker and the Dominion settlement, which has an effect on Fox, will likely have an effect on Fox going forward. And quite frankly, other right-wing platforms that can't write such big checks and stay in operation, you might begin to see a bit of a chilling effect on some of the most grotesque misinformation.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Fox Dominion case, because, of course, we can't have a conversation about Tucker Carlson without mentioning that this comes on the heels of Fox being required to pay Dominion Voting Systems $787.5 million, one of the largest defamation payouts in American history, over the allegations that the network amplified false claims that Dominion's voting technology had helped rig the 2020 election in favor of Joe Biden. You said the outcome, quote, reeks of justice without accountability. Why?
Right. Well, justice is if I have harmed somebody, compensating them. Compensation for harm is justice. But if I can continue to harm another person, then there hasn't been accountability. There hasn't been the penalty that I have not paid the penalty necessary for the harm that I've occurred, that I've caused. And what I was concerned about in the aftermath of the Fox settlement, and we don't know if the firing of Tucker Carlson has anything to do with that, but what I was concerned about in the aftermath of the Fox settlement is that they were just writing a check to pay for the privilege of continuing to be corrupt. And so we see this in businesses all the time where, for example, they will write checks to pay off victims of sexual harassment, but they won't terminate the harasser. This has been was a problem, for example, at Fox News, where businesses will commit acts of misconduct, pay the people that they've harmed, and continue on. And that was my big concern with Fox, that they were paying for the privilege of continued corruption. Now, this firing of Tucker Carlson, we don't know if it's related to the Dominion suit or not, is an indication of what it looks like when a company actually takes decisive action against the actual purveyors of malice and misinformation. That is much more impactful to the culture overall than that payment of money.
Well, if that were the case, then we would also see the firing of Jeanine Pirro and the firing of Maria Bartiromo and other Fox News hosts who also promulgated conspiracy theories and
clean
false
house,
fake news.
Right.
Yeah. So is that what true accountability would look like then to you, David?
Well, what happened at Fox was so comprehensive. This was not one rogue producer or one rogue host. This was multiple hosts, staff in multiple parts of places in the hierarchy of the organization, including at the very top, orienting Fox News, especially Fox News primetime, towards communicating outright disinformation and misinformation about the election. True accountability at Fox would look like a house cleaning, not one host. And not in truth be told, Tucker Carlson, during the actual election contest period, was not the worst of the Fox hosts on purveying misinformation. Those were others, some of the names that you mentioned. So true accountability would be cleaning house of all of the people who got up and intentionally lied to their own audience, in part because they were afraid of their audience, in part because they didn't want to lose ratings. That's what true accountability would look like. But the Tucker Carlson leaving is still quite impactful.
Let me ask you about the court. I mean, you're a lawyer. You have a fabulous podcast that unpacks legal rulings at every level. Public trust in the American judiciary and confidence in the Supreme Court in particular are at historic lows, as they are with many institutions.
Right.
But there have been a series of recent challenges, including the leaked draft of the opinion for overturning Roe v. Wade, the expanded use of emergency motions, aka shadow dockets, questions about a possible ethics lapse on the part of justices and members of their family. What is the best way to restore confidence in the Supreme Court?
That's a really good question. I mean, first, things like the Dobbs leak undermine public trust because, quite simply, that's just not supposed to happen. And we have not seen that kind of scandal out of the Supreme Court in a while, where something happens that's so out of the norm, that so breaks through all of the guardrails, that it makes you wonder if there's something going on with the institution. I think the Dobbs leak really hurt. I also think some of the ethics, some of the disclosures, even if they don't involve technically violating the rules, in other words, the hospitality exemption that allows you to do things like take private jet rides with friends or whatever, that's something that might not technically violate the rules, but to average Americans, that's not what they want to see Supreme Court justices doing. So some of this is kind of an own goal by the court, where the court can take some steps to make sure that those kinds of trips don't happen or they're completely publicly disclosed, buttoned down to where you return to the regular order of business and you don't have leaks. But then part of it, to be honest, is we have a lot of conversation about the court that I think is just frankly misguided. And here's what I mean. A lot of people look at the court as a political actor much more than it really is. And you can, in the court, the judges have philosophies, judicial philosophies, but honestly, they're not really political animals. If they were pure political animals, you would have seen, for example, very different outcomes to some of these election challenges in 2020. Instead, those of us who understood that these judges and justices operate primarily through their judicial philosophy, we knew that those 2020 challenges stood no chance at all, because they were so counter to the judicial philosophy of the various judges, both nominated by Democrats and Republicans.
You're referring to many of the judges who saw challenges the 2020 election having been Trump appointed.
Yes. And rejected them. And so I think if you understand the court is not a purely political entity. I'm not going to say that political considerations never come into play, But if you look at the court rulings in their totality, you can explain them much better by judicial philosophy than by just raw political power and calculation.
I mean, a great point to illustrate that the justices are not purely operating by their own political sensibilities or preferences was last week's ruling about the abortion drug mifepristone. After pending appeal, after a federal judge in Texas declared the FDA's approval of the drug invalid, the Supreme Court preserved access to the abortion drug, the same Supreme Court which overruled Roe v. Wade. So tell me something. Even some conservative legal experts have called the arguments advanced by the plaintiffs who want mifepristone off the market weak. And you served as a senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is the group representing the plaintiffs. On the merits, is this a case you would have been comfortable bringing?
That's a really good question. You know, look, there are problems with that case that actually have nothing to do with the merits of the FDA's approval. So you'll have problems regarding standing. Are the doctors who are the people who brought the lawsuit, do they have proper standing? You have issues with things like statutes of limitation. Was the lawsuit brought in time? And so all of those things are hovering over this as well, to the point where, let me just say this, when the Supreme Court granted the stay, I was not surprised at all. And when there are only two dissents from that decision, I was not surprised at all by that. It was a very, very, very difficult, long odds case from the beginning. And I think that a lot of legal commentators on the right recognized that and said that.
Well, the two dissents were Justice Alito and Justice Thomas. Why were you not surprised by their dissents?
Well, when you're dealing with these kinds of cases, the emergency docket or shadow docket cases, the shadow docket itself is controversial. And if you read the Alito dissent, it wasn't about the merits of the case at all. The Alito dissent was about the shadow docket. When do we take these cases on an emergency basis and when do we not? And he was saying, well, some of the justices, this was the judicial equivalent of a subtweet. He was saying, some of the justices who accepted this as on the shadow docket and ruled on the shadow docket had been very loudly critiquing the shadow docket not long ago. And so I think part of this was a jab, perhaps, at other justices on the court. But it was very interesting to me, if you read the Alito dissent and you read, Thomas didn't write anything at all, but if you read the Alito dissent, it was not upholding the merits of the lower court's injunction against the abortion drug and against the abortion pill. It was about process and it was about procedure. And I think that that is actually symbolic of some of the weaknesses of the underlying case.
So in your view, does Justice Alito have a point?
In my view, I think I understand Justice Alito's frustration, but the bottom line is the court is going to take some emergency docket cases. And these emergency docket cases are entirely in the discretion of the court as to when they're going to take them. So you're always going to have some controversy over whether this was properly done under emergency docket or should have been done under regular course. And the justices are just not going to agree on that every time. So, in my view, the court needs to take fewer cases under the emergency docket, but it's still going to have to take some. It cannot channel everything into regular order because some decisions are just too urgent. There has to be a decision reached to avoid, for example, say, chaos in the lower courts.
How do you read, then, Justice Alito's barb at his colleagues?
I think it is not unusual to see frustration. And again, I don't know if this personal frustration, let's just call it professional frustration because we can't peer into their minds. It is not unusual at all to see frustration leak into dissents. We've seen it from all sides over the course of the last many years. Ever since I was in law school, Justice Scalia was famous for his ability to deliver quite a line in a dissent. So this is something that's not terribly unusual. These are very high stakes cases. And it's still though, by contrast with the way you see members of Congress go at each other, it is quite benign and polite compared to what we've seen in other branches.
But does it say something about the diminishing collegiality on the court?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. It's really hard to say. Interestingly, we have seen, even in the last year, we have seen Justice Sotomayor, who's on one end of the court's ideological spectrum, publicly praise Clarence Thomas on completely the other end of the political spectrum for the way that he interacts with people on the court and how he knows people's names, how he's involved in people's lives. And so it's very hard to know if we're dealing with personal friction or professional friction. But I think that there is no question that there's some real professional friction on the court. And you see it all the time in dissents. Again, kind of by the contrast with Congress, it's subtle. But by the standards of the judicial branch, it can be quite pointed.
After the Dobbs decision, you wrote, quote, "The pro-life movement should greet the reversal of Roe v. Wade with a spirit of gratitude. But the movement should also show a profound humility, an absence of malice toward their political opponents." Do you feel they've heeded your advice?
Oh, I think that there has been an element of what's the old saying, the dog that caught the car, that there was a lot of unanimity in the pro-life movement around overturning Roe. But then as soon as Roe was overturned, you exposed an enormous amount of division within the pro-life movement itself, so that there wasn't a kind of united pro-life response to the overturning of Roe. And then it happened in an atmosphere, again, where, especially in these supermajority red states, there's a lot of performative punitive legislation. And so that was, in many ways, a very difficult cultural and political atmosphere on the right after Roe. And so a movement that could have moved very aggressively and directly into the public square with a program that was every bit as focused on helping moms and babies as it was on passing new restrictive laws, I think would have been a much preferable position to be in. But there's not consensus in the pro-life movement about how to move towards helping moms and babies. A couple of ideas, for example, Elizabeth Bruning of The Atlantic wrote after Roe was overturned, make birth free. In other words, moms do not have to pay money to give birth. The Mitt Romney Child Allowance Plan, for example, that provides monthly payments to moms even prenatally. These are the kinds of programs that I'm not going to say are going to eliminate opposition to the pro-life movement, but are really important to concretely meeting people where they are in the real world on an issue, financial instability, which is one of the reasons why people seek out abortions. And so I think that there is room for a pro-life message that's very holistic, but the pro-life movement itself is very divided.
There's another judicial question. Before the Supreme Court, the case Moore versus Harper.
Right. This
will determine the validity of a legal idea called the independent state legislature theory. The theory says that the state legislature has an unlimited independent power to set election rules without being subject to review by state courts. Conservative lawyer, former judge Michael Luttig, says that Moore v. Harper is, quote, "the single most important case for American democracy since the founding of the nation." Is there merit to that statement, David?
I will say it's extremely important. I'm not going to go to the founding of the nation, but it is extremely important because we're going to be moving into a 2024 cycle where if, let's say, Donald Trump loses again narrowly, this issue is going to be front and center in the United States of America. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that there are circumstances in which literally the continued unity and social peace of the country could depend on the outcome of the independent state legislature doctrine. So this is, Judge Luttig was right, this is massively important. I don't know if it's more important than, say, Dred Scott, but it's massively important for what kind of democracy that we have going forward.
Let me just unpack it a little bit. So the case involves a North Carolina Supreme Court ruling that rejected a new congressional map adopted by the state's Republican-controlled legislature over concerns of partisan gerrymandering, and the Supreme Court would be examining whether the state's highest court overstepped, since the U.S. Constitution designates the role of setting the time, place, and manner of federal elections to state legislatures. Proponents of the theory say the courts have no control over election rules and would say that North Carolina Supreme Court overstepped.
And quite honestly, I do not think the independent state legislature doctrine, as in the way that you articulated it, with the strength that you articulated it with, I don't think that will have purchase at the Supreme Court.
Why are you so confident if this did make it to the Supreme Court that there wouldn't be purchase?
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's look at it from an originalist perspective. This radically new, and it is radically new reading of the power of the state legislature, is not something we see in the history and tradition of American election regulation. It's not only not been dominant, it's not even been part of the conversation, really, about American elections. And so you're looking at a court that, to greater or lesser degree, a majority is originalist, to greater or lesser degrees, where essentially the proponents of the independent state legislature doctrine are asking them to do something pretty new, quite honestly, pretty new in a republic that's over 200 years old, and say that's consistent with the text, history, and tradition of the Constitution. And it's pretty easy to say, if you're reading the text at all through the history and tradition of American election regulation, then no, the legislature's acting completely alone without a governor's veto or state Supreme Court oversight. That is not how we have run elections in this country. And for an originalist, the question of how have we done things in the past is actually quite important.
You've said one of the highlights of your time in law school was sitting in a room with former Congressman Jack Kemp,
yeah,
listening to him detail his vision for a broader, multi-ethnic Republican Party. He made that case on Firing Line, the original version with William F. Buckley Jr., in 1987.
There are no problems in this country that we can't resolve working together. There really are no limits to the future of this country that we can't see a better life for each and every American, not only here, but from the inner city to the rural areas of America, by not only working together, but recognizing those ideas that made this country great. The inalienable rights of people were not written by Jefferson for some people, but for all people. And not for just this country, but for all country. And I want the Republican Party to be that type of a party.
Given Trump and the rise of figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene and George Santos, which, as you point out, is because of the abandonment of the concept of the character of political leaders, how does the Republican Party find redemption?
That is a really good question. Note the contrast in that language we just saw, which was quite universalist in the sense that I want to make life better for all people. I want to provide a ladder of opportunity for all people versus the dominant rhetoric you see coming from the populist reactionary right, which is I will defend you, the us, against them. But the them isn't a foreign power. The them is your fellow Americans on the other side of the aisle, which is an inherently, extraordinarily divisive, polarizing message. So, you know, there are a couple of paths forward. One, the most difficult, I think the least likely, unfortunately, is a competing message entering the Republican marketplace of ideas that says, no, let's turn back to that universalist message. Let's turn back to that message that says, we want all Americans to prosper in this country. There is no, when it comes to the United States of America, there is no us and them. It's just us. So can you confront that directly and win in the Republican primary? I'm pessimistic. The more realistic path forward might seem to be something like, well, you know, that reactionary populism, it just keeps losing. It just keeps losing and losing. And you're going to have to change course if you want to win again, which I feel like might be the more realistic path to reform. But however we get from A to B, my ideal is get to A to B through inspiration and by changing hearts and minds. But however we get to A to B, we need to get to B. We need to turn the page on this reactionary populism.
David French, thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thanks so much for having me.